Tell us about it.
Well, it was interesting. We were at home in Brooklyn. I was upstairs getting dressed. I came down. I heard my husband, Ralph, who is African-American, on the front stoop. And that's the three stairs or so that people who can't go to the Hamptons vacation on in Brooklyn. And I hear him saying, "I don't see a warrant, and I don't see any badges." Well, I look beyond him. I saw fellows who clearly were police, tights in the polyester and the shoes, and I said, "Ralph, take it easy. He's the activist. I'm the lawyer." I said, "Don't worry about it. Don't worry. We'll have you out by lunchtime." At which point, someone put his foot on the stoop and said, "We're not here for him. We're here for you." Mm-hmm. Well, it certainly was a defining moment. Your life sort of passes in front of your eyes. And I said then in my head to myself, and I said it publicly ever since, I haven't done anything. I'm not guilty of anything. And at the same time, Ashcroft was at Ground Zero having a press conference, telling them how he was keeping the country safe from the terrorist grandma. Mm-hmm. At the same moment, they were at my office because Ralph got a call after I was taken away in the car, full custodial arrest. Not Martha Stewart, who tripped in with her lawyers and signed something, but cuffs, everything. Taken to FBI headquarters right across from where we're sitting now, and processed, as they say. The amazing thing was the office was searched from 9 in the morning till 6 at night, and they seized very picky stuff at the beginning, but at the end, they just wholesale took the entire Rolodex, the entire computer, everything that we had that was a record, the files of all our cases. I don't mean the individual. Things of every name, the message books, the calendars for years and years and years. All of these became grist for their mill. And then at night, the coup de grace, of course, in their own minds, was when Ashcroft went on Letterman. Unthinking, not to be thought of, I guess I mean to say, here's a case being prosecuted by your office, and you are publicly going on television nationwide to declare the guilt of the person accused as a prosecuting official. He's not much of a lawyer, but then again, he's not much of a person either. But Ashcroft went there, sang his song, the Screaming Eagles song, and cheer-led that crowd into, we've got the terrorist lawyer, the grandma from Brooklyn, you're safe again.
Right. So now here you are on trial in the courthouse behind us, in the same courtroom, I might add, where the Rosenbergs were tried. And it brings up a lot of memories because they were arrested just a week or two after the Korean War began, and you were arrested in this 9-1-1 atmosphere. How do you see these wartime atmospheres impinging on these types of political prosecutions?
Well, definitely. I don't think any right-thinking person can escape the fact that Julius and Ethel Rosenberg went to their death because of the climate against communism. Communism was the word of the day used to smear people. And in my case, of course, terrorism is the word of the day, also used in the same manner. And when we see the kind of trial that's being conducted, in which now even bin Laden is being brought into the case, although supposedly this happened in 2000 when he was known to them, but not in the sense that he is to the city today. So, I mean, they definitely are using this T word, and they're using it to smear all of us.
Well, right at the heart of the charges against you is something called special administrative measures, which certainly has a police state ring to it. Can you tell us what special administrative measures are and what sort of restrictions this puts on the client that you represent? And how do you see an attorney's responsibilities to a client who's held in a situation like that?
Yes, well, special administrative measures came in during the Janet Reno, Bill Clinton era, and they are prison regulations directed at sort out, or well, how would you put it? We're going to have to do this one over because I didn't get the right word. But these SAMs are prison regulations that are placed against identifiable people. They are against Leonard Peltier, for example, has a set of special administrative measures which limits his ability to communicate with people from the jail. And, of course, my client, Sheikh Omar, had probably the most restrictive administrative measures placed against him. As part of these measures, the lawyer is asked to sign saying that they understand that these measures are placed against the client and they will not abridge them. And I signed that because in the 3 years I was dealing with the Sheikh under the measures from 1997 forward, I never had a problem. There was nothing, never anything that came up that was a problem because the government gave us a certain amount of yardage, I guess we would say, in which to operate as attorneys. In other words, we spoke on the phone once a week and we regularly gave him news from Egypt. We regularly read the newspaper, which under the strict letter of the law probably wouldn't be allowed, but we thought they probably did not want to get into a conflict between attorney clients and the special administrative measures. So it's interesting to note that one of the things, of course, that was prohibited is reaching out to the media. He was not allowed to reach out to the media. They were not permitted to come in to him. And even though there were repeated requests, nobody ever went and litigated that, which is what we were hoping, that one of these big guys like the Times or CNN would litigate the fact that he... any media whatsoever. But these are basically an effort by the government to silence certain people.
So these special administrative measures are actually kind of a halfway house towards Guantanamo, or towards holding people as enemy combatants without access to attorneys at all.
Right. Well, and that actually, in essence, and they attempted, I think, by means of them, to make us, his legal team, as myself and Ramsey Clark and Abdin Jabara, accessories in what they were doing. In other words, they were saying, you can't see him at all unless you see him the way we tell you to see him. And, of course, this is what happened in the Hamdi case, where Frank Dunlop, when finally, after litigating for months, got the right to see his client, an American citizen, held after Afghanistan, and then went in under such restraints, they were recording the whole time, that he went back to the judge and said, this is no visit at all. This is not a legal visit, and basically was told, take it or leave it. I mean, they did not ameliorate that now. The litigation required behind that could take years sometimes.
But we're always told that lawyer-client confidentiality is one of the sacred things in our judicial system, and yet in your trial they come out with videotapes of your meetings with your client. How could this happen? What is the justification for this?
Well, you know, it is the thing that rankles most to me, because the attorney-client privilege is the way in which we operate. It's the way a young man being questioned for jury duty on the trial said, if you can't talk to your lawyer, who can you talk to? And maybe that's where we're coming to. Who can you talk to that the government hasn't established some beachhead? And the beachhead is usually national security. They're always able to listen in if they do these magic words. It, of course, brings back to me the days of the 60s when they tried to do this with wiretap applications, thinking if they said they were doing it for national security, every judge would roll over. And that didn't happen. They were found against them for national security. Nixon couldn't listen in for national security reasons. But nowadays, they've done away with the judges, because all they have to do is go to a Mickey Mouse court, which is a FISA court for foreign intelligence, that's one, or now, under the Patriot Act, they don't even have to do that. Ashcroft can sign the authorization to set up these special cameras and listen in. I do think that all they have to do is name the client, and if it's a Muslim name, they're not going to have any problems in terms of anyone in authority getting in their way.
What sort of threat to the criminal defense bar do you think that your prosecution poses? obviously a lot of attorneys are watching this case around the country, and one of the issues that it has to pose to them is, whoa, is this going to happen to me if I come to the defense of somebody who is being prosecuted by the government?
It is a, that is one part of the issue, I think, Clark. That's the part of the issue where the attorney hangs up the phone when he gets a call from the clerk saying, do you want to do Mr. Mustafa's money laundering case? Mm-hmm. But the other part of it is more pernicious, because basically it's the lawyer who will take the case but let the government call the shots. Mm-hmm. The safe lawyer. He'll lawyer, but only up to that line the government draws. Now, this is not the tradition of activist political lawyers. Our tradition is, if the government only wants you to go so far, you're almost duty-bound to go the extra yard in order to afford your client a vigorous defense. I don't mean joining the conspiracy. Don't ever confuse that. Mm-hmm. I mean doing the vigorous kind of activist outside of defense that you need. And in many cases, such as Sheikh Omar's, it was necessary to do a big publicity case. You needed the publicity because his support did not come from around Foley Square here. It came from the Middle East, and they needed to know what was going on. So to silence him is to kill him, is to put his case outside the ken of the ordinary person picking up the paper in Cairo.
But then this led to a rather bizarre charge against you. You're charged with conspiracy to provide personnel aid to a terrorist organization, and the personnel that you're charged with providing is not yourself or your staff, but your client.
Yeah. It is a bizarre, and of course we know the judge dismissed the first indictment because he said it was so vague no lawyer could ever figure out what to do or what not to do. The second one he allowed in because it required knowledge and intent. That is knowledge on my part that I'm actually aiding a terrorist organization, and intent that I mean to do so. So he thought by doing that, what that actually did was open the door for the government to put in all manner of evidence establishing that my client is indeed a terrorist, is indeed part of a militant group in Egypt, and that I should have known that and acted differently. Well, you know, you can't define a client for a lawyer. The rules of ethics don't allow that. The government can't define it. It's all about the government's definitions. And we are prepared. You know, I'm going on the stand in another few weeks, and I'm prepared to get on that stand and say, I believe my client was wrongfully convicted, and I believe that he had a right to have some sort of speech out there. This was not what the government described as a jailbreak. By bringing his words out, because we know that in the history, the long history, the words from jail have been brought out by many, many lawyers over the years.
From Martin Luther King to Eugene Debs to whoever.
Right, to whoever. And
Thoreau.
if we just think about it, to Mumia. It's the way in which a person in jail has a voice still, even if he doesn't have a persona in the community. The government clearly wanted to do away with this voice.
Well, this is not the first time the government's tried to set you up. I remember a case a few years back here where they tried to prosecute you in another interesting example. Tell us about that.
I guess I'm the great protector of the attorney-client privilege. That was a case in state court where I represented a fellow who had been arrested in a major drug case. And my fee was delivered to the office, not by him, who was in jail, but by another person. The government subpoenaed me to a grand jury to name that person. And I said that but for being in an attorney-client privilege with my client, that person would never have been known to me, and that person was protected under the same umbrella. Of course, I went to the grand jury and refused to testify, thinking that maybe they would hold me in jail and we'd get a chance to litigate it around the jail. They didn't do that. They indicted me instead for contempt of the grand jury. It had a long checkered history. It was in the appellate courts for 4 or 5 years. But a lot of people thought that was payback for winning the Larry Davis case in the Bronx. And because I've always represented people that are, what would you say, on the cutting edge.
Unpopular in the eyes of the state.
Unpopular, yes. An enemy of the state, but never of the people.
Right.
And it actually, it finally worked out. I did take a misdemeanor plea when the judge ruled that I couldn't testify as to my reasons why I refused to testify, that it was a per se crime. But the important thing about that is it's still on appeal. Still, that has not yet been resolved. But it all goes back to, do you relate to your client? Does your client have a right to trust you with his secrets? Or are you, as a lawyer, bound to say, listen, the government could be listening in, and there's nothing we can do about it. Or we're trying to do something about it. I'm trying to do something about it. Because to me, the whole thing starts crumbling, the whole adversary system. As weak as we know it is, as poor as it is, as class-ridden, as race-driven as the criminal justice system is, some of these things still have value because of the people who work with them. Such, I hope, as myself, that I, the attorney-client privilege is safe in my hands because I won't let them come a step closer every week to take it away from the client who needs it in order to be able to defend him or herself.
Well, the government's vindictiveness towards you has actually stretched beyond the courtroom. Could you relate some of these incidents where they tried to get other clients to drop your representation?
Oh, yeah. Well, they initially, they said I was not going to be able to go in the jails to visit, that I was going to be barred from the jail.
You couldn't see your own clients who were depending on you
right,
to represent them.
Because, you know, here I was under indictment for doing something bad in a jail.
Right.
It took about, I'd say, 6 hours before they drew back on that one, realizing, you know, that there would be a furor if that ever took place. Not only by the clients, but also by the judges who were depending on me to handle the case. Secondly, they then engaged in something called the Curcio hearing, which is because your clients, because your lawyer's arrested, Mr. Client, you've got a problem here because your lawyer may not be willing to represent you wholeheartedly. She may be too worried about her whole own case.
They actually went into court where you were representing another client and tried to get the judge to inform the client that this, that they shouldn't have you as an attorney.
Right. Basically, that was the message that
right,
was delivered. It's an open-ended thing.
Yeah.
It's not you shouldn't, but it's this is what's happening with her. And I have one very smart client, a Native American woman up in Albany, New York, who actually said to the judge, I want to keep her, Judge. I love Lynn. She's great. But what do you think about my keeping her? In other words, instinctively, she understood that this was really an attack from the government and that she, trying to save her own life in front of this court, needed to make sure that the judge was not going to hold it against her for keeping me as a
right,
lawyer.
Right.
Well, he happened to be a very decent fellow, a magistrate. You know, and he said, no, no, not at all. As a matter of fact, just the opposite.
Well, I thought the bizarre thing in this, too, is that they were arguing that you would have a conflict of interest in representing these clients because in order to curry favor with the government, you might want to throw this client's case.
It really is. It's such a contradiction with the facts, actually.
Yes.
I mean, if I had wanted to curry favor, I wouldn't be in the position I'm in right now. That's for sure.
Right. Well, I also understand that a number of prominent journalists have been subpoenaed or the government attempted to subpoena them in their in your case. People who had come and interviewed you for major media. This is, seems to be another attempt by the government to isolate you from the from publicity. If reporters know that if they come and interview you, they're going to get a subpoena.
Right. Well, I think that is true. And, of course, the always reluctant press that does not want to ever be on a witness stand because they don't know how much what they consider confidential will be having to come out. The government claimed they just wanted to verify that I had these interviews, but we all know they can't relax with that. And actually, the one reporter that the judge did grant the subpoena for is the person who received the press release that I made on behalf of Sheikh Omar, who is fact-driven. But the people, such as the Times reporters, the Newsday reporters, the reporters from World War III, who were subpoenaed just because they did an interview to say, did she really say this? They were undercut by Michael Tiger's answer to them, which was, Lynn Stewart is going to take the witness stand. I'm promising that to this jury in my opening statement. and you might have a case if she doesn't take the stand. But if she takes the stand, she'll verify, as surely I will, that I had these interviews and I said some things. Some of them, of course, date back to during the trial of the sheikh. Some of them go forward, of course, to last week. But be that as it may...
They predate your alleged offense.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And the other thing is, you know, they wish to commingle my politics and the way I defend people. In my view, my politics drive the way I defend people, but not to the extent that I'm going to step over a line and become part of the criminal element. I understand my value is as a lawyer, and I'm very, very conscious of protecting that and never going over that extra edge. So that's why this prosecution came as a complete surprise. What did I think? I thought, well, if they really think I broke the regulations, the SAMs we spoke about, maybe they'll limit my ability to visit the sheikh, not take telephone calls. But to be indicted, it really is mind-boggling. It still is a mind-boggling.
And what penalties are you facing?
As of the current count, 45 years is the maximum. Mm-hmm. Of course, they can get all kinds of enhancements for terrorism, but that's what it's looking like now.
Okay. You've been traveling all over the country, speaking to different audiences, political, legal. What sort of response have you been getting?
Well, you know, I must say that I do speak a great deal to law schools, lawyers groups, and just the people whose politics would drive them to come out of an evening to hear me. Mm-hmm. So sometimes I'm preaching to the choir, but that seems to work for the choir, and it seems to work for me, mm-hmm. too. You know, you get strength from these collective back pattings of you're doing the right thing and we're with you. And to people out there who are doing the grassroots work and who need to see that, you know, at a crucial point we stand up, we don't back down. I have had overwhelmingly and amazing, you know, I'm a New Yorker, Clark, and, you know, we sometimes think everything stops west of the Hudson, that the only place where politics really go on is in New York. But I can tell you that I have been so happy and so overjoyed to find wonderful people in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, and Birmingham, Alabama, and Milwaukee, and Madison, Wisconsin, and Minnesota, and Washington, and Oregon, Tucson, mm-hmm. Arizona. I even spoke at a little law school in Phoenix where people say, boy, you're in enemy territory. And yet we had 40 or 50 people. They're mm-hmm. willing to work. They're willing to do media stuff, get the story out there, tell people why they should be concerned about this case if they want to see the Sixth Amendment to the Constitution survive.
Well, the whole climate we live in now, characterized by the so-called war on terrorism, has brought all kinds of attacks on due process, on right to be represented by counsel, culminating in indefinite detentions by executive order. How do you characterize the state of the law today in the age of Ashcroft?
Well, I think it is the state of the laws as a state of the nation. It's one of fear. It reflects that. Lawyers are not willing to go and really be extraordinarily vigilant in most of the cases that come in. There are those people that do stand up and do fight. Certainly, the Center for Constitutional Rights, when it made the decision, which was a difficult decision for them, to fight for the rights of the people held at Guantanamo, this was above what one maybe would have expected from a group that's funded, that was taking a very unpopular position. Notwithstanding that, there are the lawyers, the individual lawyers, who will fight the good fight, and it's them that we want to keep around and alive and invigorated by winning a case such as mine. And I think the movement as a whole, we want to have a victory here to try to take back a little, to try to restore, at least for the time being, three branches of government where the judiciary, by conducting this trial and allowing us to speak to a jury, where the jury can give a comeuppance to people who think that here in the heart of 911, not 10 blocks from where the World Trade Center stood, that a jury will, of course, convict anybody accused of terrorism without listening, without caring. The T word will just take them over the top. It's a worry to us. It's a worry that the jury will not think But I have a great belief in the people, and maybe in 12 of them collectively doing the right thing.